Hello, and welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. We release these episodes every week on Wednesday mornings, and the best way to support us is by clicking subscribe and taking a moment to rate the podcast wherever you are listening. If you'd like to support our efforts to keep the nonprofit Meditation Center open in Nashville, you can donate via Venmo by sending your donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can make a donation through our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, by clicking the Donate tab. And one final announcement, we are very excited to offer the Wild Heart Labor Day Weekend Loving Kindness Retreat at Heartwood Refuge in Hendersonville, North Carolina, on September 3rd through the 6th. If you'd like more information about this retreat, please visit wildheartmeditationcenter.org and click the Events tab, or you can sign up and learn more at heartwoodrefuge.org. Peace and love. Hope you enjoy. What I want to do is, and I want to take some time teasing this out, but last week I went over maybe what mindfulness is and what it isn't. And really, today I want to look at this rich tradition of mindfulness that I think it's quite important to look at what has been passed down before us. I think it's quite arrogant to think that our generation came up with mindfulness. And to really see that the mainstream mindfulness, what it's rooted in and where it goes back to, is Buddhism, 100%. And there's a part of me that takes quite reverence in what we call the three gems, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the second gem of the Dharma that I hold, I'm being held by this beautiful gem. So there's something so loving about just resting in the lineage and resting in the tradition that came before us. And understanding that mindfulness is a beautiful practice, and it's so beautiful that maybe we want to get to know where it came from. And where it came from is a 2,600-year-old tradition that started with a guy named Siddhartha Gautama, who became what we consider the Buddha. And this 2,600-year-old tradition is an oral tradition. They didn't write anything down. They just said it out loud. And people would memorize these, that they took so much refuge in this Dharma, that they would just memorize them and then chant them. And that's why a lot of these discourses are quite repetitive, because there's a lot of memorization in this. So you may hear some repetition in what I'm about to go through. And what I want to go through is the Satipatthana Sutta. Today I'm just going to go over the first part. But the Satipatthana Sutta is the discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness. Sati, this word Sati, S-A-T-I, was translated in the 1800s by a British guy into the word mindfulness, really the introduction to this word mindfulness. So Sati is the word. So you see Satipatthana Sutta. And Satipatthana most directly is translated as to remember the ground. So as sati has this term as mindfulness, it also has a quality of remembering. And not remembering like recollecting, like playing around in memory lane, but really remembering the ground, remembering this present time experience. So Satipatthana, to remember the ground, sutta, S-U-T-T-A, really means discourse. So sutta is in the Pali Sanskrit. The Sanskrit is sutra, so you may hear sutra too in different traditions. We play off the earliest form of Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, and so we use Pali, which is the earliest form. So it's like more like a commoner's language. So you'll hear sutta as a discourse. And I'm going to read part of it. I'm not going to read all of it, but from the very beginning, we are placed into the environment of the Buddha in this oral tradition. And I like really just going into finding that trust in the Dharma, that trust that this has been passed down as we listen to the way this starts. And it says, thus I have heard on one occasion the Blessed One living in Kuru country at a town of the Kurus named Kama Sa Dhamma, excuse me. There he addressed the monks thus. Monks, venerable sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this. Monks, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for the acquiring of the true method, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four Satipatthanas. So while we put trust in this dialogue that's happening, this dialogue starts with really awakening, Nibbana, or Nirvana, you may hear in Sanskrit. So really that this practice of mindfulness can really lead us to awakening, and whatever that means, awakening. It can lead us from liberation, the ending of dukkha, the ending of suffering. And so really having some sort of trust in whatever that means, liberation, awakening, the ending of suffering, that a lot of people have done this practice specifically for all these years, and they have ended suffering. They have awoke. And so we are in line with this beautiful tradition to keep going and passing this down more and more in our own unique ways. And so he says this is how you do it in these four satipatthanas, for these four foundations of mindfulness. The first foundation, what we'll go over today, is mindfulness of the body. In this body that we have mindfulness of breathing, we have mindfulness of the body parts, we have mindfulness of the makeup of this body, we have mindfulness of the activities of the body, we even have mindfulness of the decay and dying of this body. So that's the first foundation, is really finding this present time awareness of this autonomic nervous system, what's naturally happening, or the breath is naturally happening. So we can be with some present time, simple present time awareness in this first foundation. Really in this first foundation, it gives us the beauty to be like, not right now, mind. We get space from the mind at first. And then we open up to the second foundation. And the second foundation is mindfulness of feelings. And this word feelings, there's so many different definitions of the word feelings. In this case, it's something called Vedana. And Vedana is very simple. It's anything from our senses. It's felt as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The sights you're seeing right now are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You're seeing me, and I'm like super handsome, so I'm assuming it's like pleasant Vedana, right? Okay, well, maybe not. And, you know, whatever my feelings in my feet are getting a little pressure, unpleasant feeling. So we'll play around with that probably next week. The third foundation is mindfulness of mind. When we use the mind to view the mind. And not only using the mind to view the mind, but also knowing what a mind state is. And rather than getting wrapped up into the dialogue and the drama and the thought processes, we observe a thought. And what's the attitude of the mind? Is it greed? Is it hatred? Is it ignorance? Is it loving kindness? Is it compassion? And we take a step back and look at the mind in this third foundation. And then the fourth foundation is mindfulness of dhammas. And mindfulness of dhammas is really how we use mindfulness to contemplate things like the Four Noble Truths, things like the five aggregates, the five hindrances, the seven factors of awakening, all these lists that we tend to have in early Buddhism. We bring those into mindfulness in a really experiential way, contemplate them. And so this is the menu. Like, oh, we're looking over the menu right now. And let's go towards what we're actually going to dig into. And this is this first foundation. And in this first foundation, we have the way we start it is, here, monks, in regard to the body, a monk abides contemplating the body, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desire and discontent in regard to the world. So I just wanted to introduce that. That could be a whole talk in and of itself. But when we start with this is where we're starting our meditation. Before we go even into meditation, What we want to do is set aside desire and discontent in regard to the world. So this desire and discontent is the craving and the hating, the greed and hatred, the liking and not liking, really trying to set aside preferences at first, setting aside desire and discontent. And you may hear us give these instructions, nowhere to go, nothing to do, no one to be. And this is a callback to this, setting aside desire and discontent in regard to the world. Because we'll find ourselves in meditation, sitting around planning, you know, what am I going to do after this? What's work going to be like tomorrow? Regretting something we did today. Oh, I really fucked up that email or whatever. Those things do happen, of course. But we want to set the intention to set aside those things for a while. And so this is the first instructions to set aside all that. Take a break from the world for a while, and we can go into this meditation. And so we enter into this first foundation. And how, monks, does one in regard to the body abide contemplating the body? Here, gone to the forest, or root of a tree, or an empty hut, one sits down, having folded their legs crosswise, set their body erect, and establish mindfulness in front of them. Mindful one breathes in, mindful one breathes out. So we start with this, finding a place to sit. Gone to a forest, gone to a tree, gone to an empty hut. And I like this starting the instruction by arriving into your environment. Like, we set up a beautiful meditation center here. This is our empty hut. But I even in my personal practice find my meditation spot. I got a beautiful meditation spot in my home. It's the cleanest place in my home because it's my place set out for meditation. And I think this even is the first lesson of, for me, is take care of your environment. Take care of your space. There was a story, I was on retreat and somebody was laughing about my teacher, the Venerable Panyawati. They just overheard her say to one of her students, they're on retreat, and they went up to her and was like, I just had the most amazing, profound experience. You know, this pure bliss and this beauty and this big insight. And they're going on and on and on to her about this wonderful insight they had. And she goes, you know what? I saw your room and your room's a mess. You need to make your bed. Yeah. And really, that this is like to take care of your space. Take care of your environment. We can be grasping for all this beautiful bliss and insight. But first things first, take care of what you're doing. And I started in the Zen tradition, and these cushions are very important. Before we enter the room, we bow to the room. We take, you know, want to come in with a certain amount of appreciation to this room that we're in. And then we go to the cushion, and then we bow to the cushion. And then we turn to the room, and then bow to whoever's in front of us, and we bow to the Sangha. And I think there's something beautiful about taking care of your space. And then when you get up from your meditation cushion, you set it up for the next person. You take care of it, you move it around, you fluff the pillow up, and then you bow to it, and then you bow to the Sangha. And before every time you sit in meditation, and really taking that mindful awareness about your environment is a part of our practice. And even in that Sangha, something my teacher would get on to me all the time about if I left the bathroom a mess, what would happen is I'd wash my hands and there'd be specks of water on the sink. And he'd say, oh, you need to wipe off the sink. And always getting on to me about wiping down the sink. Oh, you got to leave the sink nice. And he had a towel next to the sink. So anytime you use the sink, you wipe down the sink. Leave your space set up for the next person. And there's a certain amount of gratitude for that and a lot of practice in that. Because we get busy, oh, I gotta go. I'm gonna be late for the meditation. Or I gotta go do this. I gotta do that. And then we come back to the groundedness of take care of the meditation cushion. Make your bed. Wipe down the sink. Very simple. And another thing about environment that it doesn't really clearly go into the instructions. And what we'll find, these instructions are leave room for interpretation too. To have like even like trauma-informed mindfulness, because arriving in our space is quite freeing. And when we get in meditation, sometimes some things pop off, am I right? And we have these traumatic impulses that make us quite small. But something about living in the spaciousness of our environment, of knowing the sounds around us, knowing the air on the skin, knowing the vast spaciousness around us, of being involved in this environment, not separate from this environment, is quite soothing and deactivating, I find, too. And then I'll move on to the next line that probably the most exciting part of this is... let me go to the posture. Having folded legs crosswise and body erect, mindfulness in front of you. And so sometimes we can get really uptight about like our sitting posture. Like, oh, it says, you know, sitting with crossed legs. But that's just how they sat at the time. So if you want to sit in a chair, you sit in a chair. And you sit in a cushion, you sit in a cushion. I find for me, I can sit in a cushion longer than I can sit in a chair. That's actually why I sit cross-legged. And it's something fun too. I remember being a kid sitting on the floor, and it was like kind of nice sitting on the floor. So I have some good memories about sitting on the floor. And so that's why I do it. But having purposefulness and sturdiness in this posture, or it says the body erect, and like having an upright spine really helps us feel this mindfulness in front of us that it brings up. And of course, we don't want to go beyond our own physical abilities. But really, feeling this body upright and purposeful, it's quite important to have a stillness and a sturdiness in the body, and then just letting go and letting whatever arises arise when we do this. Staying still with this upright, cross-legged posture. And mindfulness in front of us. And so when we go into mindfulness of breathing, what we discover is many different techniques throughout traditions develop on how to have mindfulness of breathing. Some will say the first practice I got was in through the nose and then out through the throat. You feel it in the nose and the throat. And then that, out of habit, that's what I do. Some will say in the belly, the rising and the falling of the belly, in and out, the rising and falling of the belly. There's so many different ways to pay attention to the breath, but here it says just having mindfulness in front of you, that the breath just lives in front of you. Just so feeling that breath in front of you. So whether it is the nose, the throat, the mouth, the chest, the belly, just know this mindfulness in front of you. So from the body, from the breath, just living right here. And then it goes into breathing in long, one nose, I breathe in long. Breathing out long, one nose, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, one nose, I breathe in short. Breathing out short, one nose, I breathe out short. Establishing this mindfulness of breathing and noticing the curiosity of the breath. Is that a long breath? Is that a short breath? And so this mindfulness of breathing is quite beautiful because it can give us a break from the mind for a while. And not that mindfulness is all about getting rid of our thoughts, but isn't it nice when you can do that? And finding that power to place awareness, when our awareness runs all over and then we can train us to be with the breath. Oh, is this a short breath, a long breath, being curious with this breath? The awareness wanders, and then we're training back to the breath, and having a sense of curiosity with the breath. And really, this is an impossible task for the most part. Your awareness will wander off into the stories, into the judgments, and the yada, yada, yadas, the plans and fantasies of life. But we want to just keep coming back to this breath and developing a sense of curiosity. And we may get really judgmental about this because we may count our failures. And I've said this before, mindfulness is one insult after another. You're going to fail over and over and over again. But if you just have that one beautiful breath, if you have that one breath that was present, and I wasn't lost in my worries, I wasn't lost in my regret, and you just stay with that one breath, it's a very beautiful breath. There's even that book, One Breath at a Time. Who wrote that?
Kevin
Griffin. Yeah. One breath at a time. So even if you can just be mindful with this one breath, it can be quite a beautiful refuge. And it continues to, one trains thus, I shall breathe, experiencing the whole body, and breathing in, and I shall experience the whole body breathing out. I shall breathe, calming the bodily formation, I should breathe out, calming the bodily formation. So, whether there's a lot of discrepancy in this, I saw a room of like 40 people, half monastics, half lay people, go into what this line means. Experiencing the bodily formation. Does this mean the body? Does this mean the breath, the full body of the breath? I don't know. There's plenty of people that will go on and on about what they feel about this. I don't know. But I like this aspect of calming the bodily formation. So if we can stay with our breath, and you notice it starts with long, notice the breath is long. Because normally when we sit down in meditation, the breath is quite long. Because we're just normally breathing. We just walked in the room, we're breathing. And then you notice it goes to short. And then we sit in meditation a little bit, start shortening a little bit. And then you notice calm starts arising. And this beautiful calm that arises, there's even qualities of what we call piti sukha, bliss and rapture, in this mindfulness of breathing. That if you sit still with the body erect in this stillness, and you're noticing the breath do its natural thing. Not that we're supposed to control the breath, but just notice the breath is long. And then you calm a little bit, the breath is short. And then you notice this body starts getting a nice sweet tingling to it. And you may have that just by sitting still with the breath and not getting wrapped up in the future or the past, just being present. The body starts feeling really nice. And like a lot of times it'll happen in the hands. Or at the heart center. And it just feels nice just to sit still with the breath for a while. And just knowing that that beauty is available that comes from seclusion. What we call seclusion, it's seclusion from the hindrances, seclusion from that desire and discontent for the world. So if we can be exclusionary to greed and hatred, when we come to this moment, there is a beauty that comes from that seclusion, from the world. Taking a break from the world and seeing like, wow, this is quite beautiful. Just being with this breath. It says, just as a skilled turner or his apprentice, when making a long turn, knows, I make a long turn. Or making a short turn, I make a short turn. So breathing in long, one knows I breathe in long. So I don't know what a turner is, but it's the idea that this is a skill to develop. We may, okay, my first day meditating, I can't stay with the breath. My mind is wandering off over, I'm a bad meditator. Well, yeah, no shit, you just started. So this is like the skill you gotta develop. Just like a skilled turner, whatever that is. Like get a skill of being with the breath. Just show up day after day. Showing up for this breath, showing up for meditation, you'll get better at it, I promise. And then it goes into posture. So that's the mindfulness of breathing. That's what we start with. Finding our environment, sitting with the breath, and then we move on to postures. And so just like when I'm guiding a meditation and I ring the bell, I don't want you to stop meditating. This is the instruction to keep mindfulness going. So this is where we talk about any postures, when walking, when standing, when sitting, when lying down, anything you're doing. Just because we're meditating and we're keeping this mindfulness during a meditation doesn't mean the bell rings, stop. Just keep going, keep mindfulness, keep meditating. And anything you're doing, and you're working, work. When you're driving, drive. When you're sitting, sit. When you're walking, walk. And just keep that mindful awareness as you leave your cushion. It's just a lot easier in sitting meditation, right? So we train easier, and then the real work gets there. It gets going when we're out in the world and we're around all the busyness and distractions. And then it goes into not only in any posture, but anything we do, like any activity. It says, monks, when going forward and returning, one acts clearly knowing. When looking ahead and looking away, one acts clearly knowing. When flexing and extending one's limbs, one acts clearly knowing. When wearing one's robes and carrying one's outer robe and bowl, one acts clearly knowing. When eating, drinking, consuming food, and tasting, one acts clearly knowing. When defecating, when urinating, one acts clearly knowing. When walking, standing, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent, one knows. So keeping this mindfulness as we're taking a shit. Yeah. And it goes into shit some more, so don't worry. To be continued. Hopefully we have time to go into that more. So keep this, sustaining this mindfulness in anything you're doing. And then from there on, we go into the body. We go into the 32 anatomical parts of this body. And we want to maintain a mindfulness of body. That all experience happens through this body. So it's good to maintain the awareness of this body as all these senses and as all these impulses arise in this body. And then there's so much freedom of being in this body, and there's so much comfort being in this body. And as I bring in maybe some more modern language around this, around like traumatic impulses, we may not feel safe in our body. Something like the amygdala that stores fight, flight, freeze response and traumatic impulses really disembodies us. Because when we are getting a trigger from a traumatic impulse, our body goes offline because we feel like it's go time. It's that feeling that arises. Something from memory triggers us, and then we feel a traumatic impulse. Our body goes offline because we feel like, oh, it's time to run from the thing that's going to eat me. You know, this quite primitive thing. And so keeping a mindfulness of body really rewinds some of this very activations. It rewinds a lot of the traumatic impulses. And it can give us a place to find home inside of ourselves, which can be very difficult. And at the same time, I don't know if this is what the Buddha's message was, but maybe by accident, this is something he stumbled upon. So keeping mindfulness of body in this even modern context of finding ease and gentleness and softening the body and finding a home in the body can be quite helpful. And at the same time, looking at the tradition, one reviews this body up from the shoulders and down to the feet, the top of the hair. Enclosed by skin, full of many kinds of impurities thus. In this body, there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, sinews, bone marrow, kidney, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lung, bowels, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, I promised it for you, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. And so we want to keep some mindfulness of all of this. Having mindfulness of the liver and the spleen and the urine and the pus and the blood and the feces. And then he continues on, just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends, full of many sorts of grains, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, white rice. And a man with good eyes, were to open it, and review it thus. This is hill rice, this is red rice, this is beans, this is peas, this is millet. So too, we review the body. So it's these openings at both ends. So the Buddha's kind of being crude right now, that we have these two ends, you know, right? So, and in these two ends, all sorts of things come in and out of those two ends. And we need to know these impurities thus, you know, that these two ends of all these parts that are quite, lack of better term, disgusting. And so while we can use insight into so many things with this mindfulness, the first one I see here is the non-identification with this body. That we need to see that this body by nature is kind of gross. And I'll get into what I mean by that, but it has these disgusting aspects that it shits and it pukes and it has bile and it has fat and spittle and oil to joints, and it has these so-called, what they said, impurities to the body. And I don't mean this in a way to create aversion. We don't want to hate this body. So there's a discourse that explains this well. I believe it's the Buddha's advice to Rahula. And Rahula was the Buddha's son. So when Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha to be, left his palace, left his home, he left a family behind. And he went for 7 years to go be a monk, and then he discovered this awakening, this mindfulness, he discovered it. And then later on he met up with his son, and his son wanted his inheritance. And what happened was he inherited this spiritual life. Rahula, the Buddha's son, became a monk himself. And in this tradition that the monks and the nuns don't eat unless it's freely given. So they'd go around begging for food. And they have their begging bowls and ask for food. On one occasion, the Buddha was out begging for food, and a group of monastics were out begging for food, and Rahula was there too. Now Rahula was slightly behind the Buddha, and Rahula was looking at the Buddha and thinking, wow, my dad is like tall and handsome and strong. And he's really thinking, my dad's sexy, you know? And he was thinking, well, I'm going to grow up to be just as sexy as him, you know? So he's finding this value in sexiness, you know, looking a certain way. And the Buddha heard his thoughts. He was the Buddha, he could read minds. So he heard Rahula's thoughts and stopped him. And his advice to his son, is way different than advice my father gave me. What he taught him was these disgusting aspects of the body. He taught him that his body is made up of all of these blood and pus and phlegm and fat and spittle. For one, not to take this body so personal. This body will get sick, it'll age, it'll die, and all of those things. But I really think there's a message of beauty, too. What he went into is the next part of this sutta, which is the four elements. In mindfulness, we want to look at that the earth element, that this body has hard parts, earth. We have fire elements like digestion and heat in the body. We have water elements like saliva, tears, and urine. And then wind element like this breath. And so he started talking about the disgusting aspects of the body and then these four elements. So on one end, don't take this body personal, and at the same time, see that you are not separate from all things in life. That while we may have a periodic table, but at that time, what they had was these four elements, and noticing that we are made up of all the same substances as all things are. And the only thing that really separates us is our delusion, that this mind makes up a self, and we make up an identity in the mind to discriminate and separate. But see how incorrect that view is, and see how you are part of this, and that's fucking beautiful. So sometimes we confuse competition, being sexier than somebody as beauty. That's sad. That's separate. Somebody that's had so much trouble trying to find a place to belong, I never thought I'd find it in the disgusting aspects of my body. But really looking at, you know, this element of shit, of eating food, how beautiful is that? That we can eat some food and shit it out. Fucking amazing, isn't it? So we confuse what is attractive for what is beautiful. But this is like, no, flip it. Some of these so-called disgusting aspects are quite beautiful. Like taking a shit. So next time you take a shit, be like, whoa, this is beautiful. And like call your friends in and be like, look how beautiful this shit is. Maybe that's something.
You know what the acronym for shit is, don't you?
No.
Simply how I think.
Oh, well. Exactly. It's simply how you think. You take this shit and you make it beautiful. But yeah, but like this competition of being sexy and all of that, that's just, it's hard. And be sexy, please, you know. I'm not going to diss on that, you know. Look at me, God, you know, like, come on. Yeah, just due to time, I'm going to end it there. We have one more thing left in this first part, in the first foundation of mindfulness that maybe I left out just because of time, is death contemplation. What the instructions are is really to look at a dead body decaying and know that you are of the same nature. But, you know, sensitivity to the topic, I'll just go into some mindfulness.